stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
This is Ethan with the Gamer's Haven Podcast, and this is an interview I did with Mr. Greg Kostikian, who's another name that you might not recognize, but if you go and look at your gaming shelf, you might find some stuff in there that that he's done. Most notably, he's one of the original developers and creators of the Paranoia role-playing game from West End Games, and he's also one of the people who did the Star Wars RPG from West End Games. So sit back and enjoy.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items. This is Ethan with the Gamer's Haven Podcast, and I am here with Mr. Greg Kostikian. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm not too bad.
Now, Mr. Greg Kostikian is, as I've found in interviewing people, there are a lot of names out there that people in the hobby industry might not immediately recognize, and sadly, I think Greg Kostikian may be one of them, but if you go and look at your gaming shelf, you'll probably find a few books with his name in it. So, I kick this off by wanting to ask, just how did you get into the actual gaming hobby? What got you to pick up dice the first time?
I played all kinds of board games as a small kid, and somewhere along the line, people gave me a copy of Diplomacy, which I loved. And I also had a friend when I was, 12, 13, 14, who played Avalon Hill games, so I started playing games with him. Mm-hmm. But when I was a teenager in high school, SPI, which was then one of the major publishers of war games, had open playtests on Friday nights at their offices in New York. So I would go there and hang out and make a nuisance of myself and play games. So, yeah.
What was the first thing you played? Just those SPI games?
Well, probably, like Africa Core, some of the early Avalon Hill games were probably the first things I played.
Excellent, excellent. How'd you get into actually writing and working in the industry?
Well, let's see. So, I hung out at SPI a fair bit, and at one point the guys who worked in the back room, essentially assembling and shipping games, tried to unionize, and Jim Dunnigan, who ran the company, fired them all. And he hired me and a bunch of other teenagers to basically work in the back room. And he did not even pay us in cash. He paid us in company script that we could take up to the front desk in exchange for games that they published, which at the time we thought was a good idea. But after a while, I had their entire inventory, and started selling the company script to other people at like 80 cents on the dollar, at which point Dunnigan decided maybe he should pay us minimum wage. But when I was 16, he put me on the design staff, originally as a kind of gopher, making copies of playtest maps and Xeroxing rules and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then started doing some development work with other designers, and actually my first game was published when I was 16, which was a terrible game. Was one of four games published as the North Africa Quad, which were four games with a common rule set based on different battles in Africa. And I did a game on the Battle of Alamein.
Mm-hmm. What led you up to working at West End Games, or working for West End Games, I should say?
Well, okay, so just to go through the history a little bit. So I continued doing games for SPI as a freelancer throughout high school and college. When I graduated from college, shortly thereafter, SPI went bankrupt. And I spent a couple of years as a freelance game designer doing games for, among others, Victory Games, Steve Jackson Games, Avalon Hill. And my first year as a freelance game designer, I made $6,000. And my second year, I made $12,000. And the trend was obviously in the right direction, but I figured maybe I should go back get an actual job. And at that point, West End Games, which had been kind of a hobby operation run by the guy who owned the company, Daniel Scott Poulter, decided they were going to try to convert into a larger operation. And they were publishing games on a more regular basis. And I submitted a game to them. They published one of my games as a freelancer. And when I started looking for a job, they kind of indicated that they would be interested in hiring me. So I said, okay, fine. When I went there, there were basically three people at West End. And shortly after I joined them, Eric Goldberg, with whom I worked at Crossover, also joined the company. And he was the number two at the company. I was the number three at the company for a couple of years. And in the course of our time there, we turned it from a company doing about $100,000 a year in business to a company doing about $2 million a year in business. Nice. So in many ways, I kind of view that as my first startup, even if, sure. even if I was not the founder and I didn't have equity.
And while you were at West End Games, you, of course, worked on some very flagship games in the gaming industry. Let's start off by talking about Paranoia.
Okay. So the idea behind Paranoia was came up with by a local game master named Dan Gilber, who I used to play in his games a fair bit. Mm-hmm. And it was actually his kind of inspiration was there was one player of his who was a real kind of power gamer and argued about the rules all the time, and he wanted to come up with a setting that could allow him to basically undercut this guy whenever he wanted to. Mm-hmm. I played, he ran Paranoia at one point, I played it, I thought it was a lot of fun, and I kind of said, Dan, you know, why don't you like give me what you've got, and I'll try to turn it into a professional manuscript and see if we can get it published. And he said, okay. And he handed me about five pages of scribbled notes. but on the other hand, that you know, I certainly had designed games with less to go by previously. And I did a manuscript for the game and submitted it around and was roundly rejected by everybody.
Sure.
And then when Eric came to work at West End, he said, what about that Paranoia thing you and Dan were trying to do? Maybe we should take a look at that. And so we pulled that out and started working on it. You know, Ken Ralston was kind of critical to that. He was kind of the person who came with the voice of the computer and really injected the kind of sense of humor to the game that really was made the game successful. But when we first published the game, the industry was completely skeptical that this was going to make any sense whatsoever. West End at that point was primarily a publisher of board war games.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And we're calling the distributors saying, oh, we're doing a role-playing game, but you're a war game. Well, we're doing a role-playing game, and it's set in a world run by an insane computer. Oh. What? And it's funny. It's like, uh-huh. So we shipped the game shortly before Origins, and I forget what year, 84, maybe 84.
I think it was 84.
And we had shipped maybe 120 copies to our distributors. The orders, pre-orders were amazingly low. And at Origins, we basically sat there at the booth and demoed the game for people. And you can demo Paranoia in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And was, you know, kind of the talk of the convention. We sold 300 copies on the show floor. We had to air freight an additional. In other words, we sold more copies at Origins than we had to distributors all across the country. And at that point, the distributors woke up and said, okay, maybe there's something here.
Right.
Yeah,
we just actually spoke to, I just spoke to Alan Varney not too long ago. So
uh-huh.
How do you feel about the, how far that Paranoia has come? It's become one of the, I think anyway, one of the staples of the industry. It's been around so long now.
It's nice that it's still surviving after 25 years. It's still out there. I think next year actually is the 25th anniversary, or maybe it's this year. No, I guess it's next year.
I think it was yeah. Last year.
Oh, well, whatever. So, you know, it's just nice that it's still in print, really.
Sure. And probably one of the chief reasons I wanted to talk to you was a big point of contention, and probably one of the first, to my knowledge, first big licensed works was the Star Trek, Star Wars RPG.
Right.
And according to the book I've got, you were very heavily involved in that. So, tell us about that process.
Again, whatever year that was, 84, 85, Lucasfilm, there hadn't been a Star Wars movie for a while, and there wasn't going to be one for another while, and I had kind of the feeling that doing a role-playing game was one way of kind of keeping the franchise alive during the fallow period. Mm-hmm. And so he contacted all of the major publishers in hobby gaming at the time, and, basically shopping the rights to do a Star Wars role-playing game. Okay. And so Eric Goldberg and I flew out to talk to them, and among the people we talked to were the people at their games division, because Lucasfilm, now LucasArts, is of course a pretty substantial publisher of computer games. And I walked into their computer game division, and the first person I saw was Chip Morningstar. Now, Chip Morningstar is one of the creators of Habitat, which is like the first graphical virtual world. It's considered a major talent in the development of that whole end of the industry. But he had also been a friend of my roommate, Tom Gould's, and had, stayed at my apartment. And Noah Falstein, who was also working at Lucasfilm at the time, was familiar with my work from SBI. So we had kind of internal advocates within Lucasfilm who were saying these guys know what they're doing.
Sure.
As it happens, the company that was bidding, the most serious bidder against us for the rights to the Star Wars role-playing game was TSR. TSR bid $70,000. Dan Poulter, who was running the company, decided to kind of bid $100,000. Maybe they went with us because they thought we're good guys, and maybe they went with us because we're the high bidder, or, maybe it was a little bit of both. But I do note that a few years later, TSR paid $100,000 for the rights to the Buck Rogers gaming license, which undoubtedly had nothing to do with the fact that Lorraine Williams, who was then majority owner and president of the company, also was the heir to the Buck Rogers fortune.
Right.
clearly in their, commercial judgment, unbiased by any other factors, Buck Rogers was a more valuable license than Star Wars. So went back home, started work on Star Wars role-playing game. Whenever you're dealing with a licensor, there are potential issues involved in terms of what you can do and what you can't do. Lucasfilm was actually pretty easy to deal with in this regards. They made it very clear to us up front what we couldn't do. TSR had previously done an Indiana Jones role-playing game.
Right.
And one of the constraints under which they had operated was that Indiana Jones could never die. Which is kind of a problem in a role-playing game. So we made a strong argument for, why we had needed to have a little bit more creative freedom, and they bought that. Lucasfilm was actually very easy to work with in many regards. Now, when Eric and I had gone to work for West End 2.5 years previously, the president of the company, the owner of the company, had kind of said, let's get this off the ground. There's equity in it for you down the line. And we had said, fine. And during the course of the Star Wars development, we kind of went to Dan and said, look, this company has really turned into something. Let's talk about the equity relationship. What is the deal here? And Dan, or Scott, as he is more familiarly known now, kind of said, well, just get the game out, and we'll talk about it afterwards. So we got the game out, and then we went to talk to Dan at his offices in Long Island. And the thing about this is, Daniel Scott Poulter ran a company called Bucci Imports Inc., which was then the exclusive American importer of the Bruno Magli line of Italian women's shoes, handbags, and belts, and was basically raking in millions of dollars every year from this relationship. And because he was a gamer, was pumping his money into a game company because he liked doing that, and who knows, maybe it would make money. So we went out to talk to him, and he basically said, well, let's talk about your severance arrangement. So this is, important life lessons to learn is get it in writing.
Sure. right. Well, with the Star Wars RPG, a real quick question is, quick comment. They were shopping the IP around. People weren't actually looking for it.
You know, people had contacted them previously. I remember Redmond Simonson's at SBI years previously contacting them about the rights, and they were kind of not interested at the time, or thought they were worth much more money than was reasonable for a small hobby game publisher to pay at the time.
Sure.
But yeah, no, at that point they were shopping the rights around.
Oh, interesting. And West End held on to those rights for quite some time and put out a few editions of the game, didn't they?
A lot of supplementary material. I think they probably, if West End had not gone bankrupt, I'm sure they would probably have continued to support the game indefinitely. But
you've actually sat down and did you design the system for the Star Wars RPG, or were you more dealing with the licensing aspect from it?
I designed the game basically from top to bottom. So one of the things I did is I sat down and I said, this is an opportunity to reach an audience of people who are not necessarily gamers. D&D was all of our introduction to role-playing gaming. There are a lot of things not to like about D&D, but there are some things D&D does very well.
Sure.
And one of them is to give you an immediate hook into role-playing. Just your character class and your alignment is like, okay, now I have some idea how I'm supposed to behave. Mm-hmm. So the idea of character I wanted a skill-based system. I didn't want to have character to have levels, but I came up with the idea of the character templates in which you'd start as a young Jedi or one thing or another, and you could then customize it a bit, but you have some kind of hook into role-playing from the very beginning. The other thing I wanted is so most skill-based systems prior to that time had been along the lines of RuneQuest, where you rolled D100 against your skill, so you max out at some point. You can't get above a skill level of 100, obviously, and there always has to be some chance of failure.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted a system that allowed for infinite progression the way a level system did, which is where I came up with the idea for what ultimately West End turned into the D6 system.
Right.
Yeah. And then another aspect of it is I wanted a game that kind of supported the kind of cinematic stunts of the style of Star Wars. So yeah. So those were kind of my design objectives for the game.
Oh, excellent. And you mentioned a bit about the designing a game for a licensed product. How restrictive was that?
In the case of the Star Wars role-playing game, it was fairly straightforward. We could never take the helmet off of a stormtrooper. None of the major characters from the book could die. We couldn't violate what was kind of canon as established by the three movies,
right.
Although we did not necessarily have to adhere to what happened in, say, the radio drama adaptation, this kind of stuff, or the comic book. There were some things in the comic book that they didn't like, so we didn't have to consider that as part of canonical. But other than that, there were certain things they said you can and can't do, and we said fine, and we paid attention to that. So, I've dealt with other licensors who have been total pains in the ass to deal with. We've also dealt with other licensors who basically didn't give a crap, and it's just like, as long as it's mm-hmm. we don't care. Lucasfilm was kind of somewhere in the middle there.
Okay. Now, moving on from West End Games, what did you do after that?
After that, Eric and I both left West End.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good relationship with Lucasfilm. George Lucas was working on this new movie, which we were told was going to do for fantasy what Star Wars had done for science fiction, called Willow.
Uh-huh.
So we made a kind of three-way deal with Tor Books, actually with St. Martin's Press, which is the parent company of Tor Books, and Lucasfilm to do games based on Willow. And so Tor actually published a game called The Willow Game, which I designed, also a role-playing source book done by Alan Horney called The Willow Source Book. We also had a board game which we commissioned from Sid Saxon that never got published.
Hmm.
Yeah. If you do not know Sid Saxon, he's the designer of Acquire, and Bazaar, and many other kind of very excellent games from the 50s and 60s.
Sure, sure. And you also were involved a bit in the Toon game for Steve Jackson Games, is that correct?
So Toon I actually designed back before I went to work for West End.
Oh, really? Okay.
When I was a freelancer. And I actually came out of a discussion I had at Origins one year with Jeff D., who said, you know, the one kind of genre we haven't done is Saturday morning cartoons, but of course you couldn't really do that. And we all kind of laughed and said, you couldn't really do that. And then I went home and I thought, well, why couldn't you do that? So the original design for Toon was actually an article, like 5,000-word, very short type kind of game article, you know, which I submitted to the Space Gamer, and Steve Jackson accepted it as an article. And when Warren Spector went to work for Steve Jackson, he came across this thing in their files and got excited by it and said, this really needs to be game in its own right. It's not just a magazine article. So he then elaborated very extensively, and Toon is at least as much his work as it is mine.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Spector, of course, has gone on to an eminent career as a digital game designer, currently working on Epic Mickey for Disney.
Yep. I think Alan Varney mentioned he was doing some work with him with that. So,
Alan and Warren both worked at Steve Jackson Games together. They're old friends, and Warren has often brought Alan in on various projects.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Speaking of the computer game and the video game world, you've done quite a bit in there as well, haven't you?
Yes. So after the Willow game, I was then married, and my wife had an MBA and was working on Wall Street and making lots more money than I. So it seemed to make sense for me to essentially become a house husband and stay at home while they brought in the bacon.
Sure.
And so for several years, that's pretty much what I did. But I also wrote three novels during that period, and also did a couple of products for Prodigy. Prodigy was a commercial online service before the internet was open to commercial use.
I remember Prodigy.
Yeah, had about 2 million members at its height. So with Eric, I did a game for them called Mad Maze, which was kind of a graphic adventure. I like to claim that it is the first online game to attract more than a million players, which in fact is true, although it's less impressive than it sounds, because if you were on Prodigy back in the day, there were not a lot of games to play, and most of them sucked. if you wanted to find a game, you played our game. On the other hand, you know, still. The other thing I did for them was a kind of fantasy fiction serial called By the Sword, which ran in 26 weekly installments. I got the print publication rights for that and sold it as a novel to Tor Books later.
Mm-hmm.
Some years after that, my marriage started to come to an end, and I had to get work right quick. And in the meantime, Eric had founded a company called Crossover Technologies, which was at the time the largest computer game developer in New York City.
Right.
And I went to work for them and did a whole series of products, including some weird things. We did a making of the movie CD-ROM called Behind the Mask, which was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did a game called Evolution, which was funded by Discovery Channel Multimedia and published by Interplay, which is kind of a civilization-like sim game, but you're evolving life from the earliest tetrapods up through intelligence rather than building cities and conquering the world. It's actually not a good game. it was fun to work on. And also did a game called Fantasy War, which was for Sony Online Entertainment, and ran on the station at Sony.com for a couple of years. Kind of world conquest fantasy game with a richly detailed world. Very cool game, I still think. Badly marketed, and probably with a business model that didn't work at the time. But, hey. And after that, I founded a company called Unplugged Games, which was one of the first North American mobile games companies.
Mm-hmm.
doing games for actually for WAP funds before Brew and G2ME were really on the horizon. And then worked for Nokia for several years as a games researcher, and then founded Manifesto Games, which was a publisher and distributor of independently created PC games, and now kind of back to freelance game design and consulting.
Excellent. And, so you've done a lot of work doing design for both computer games and for tabletop stuff. What kind of crossover in that design process have you noticed or do you utilize?
There are people who maintain that digital games are something entirely different from non-digital games, and you never the twain shall meet, which I personally think is complete and utter horseshit. Every game style has its own aesthetic.
Sure.
Obviously, the aesthetic of, say, a war gamer is not the aesthetic of a role-playing gamer, which is not the aesthetic of someone who's like into indie RPGs, which is not the aesthetic of someone who is into space shoot-em-ups. And it's always important to figure out what the aesthetic is. And it's also important sometimes to say, I see why people like this, but it really doesn't appeal to me, and I'm probably not the right person to be designing this kind of game. But in terms of kind of underlying structure, the way rules systems combine to create effects for people, that I think is fundamental across all game styles.
Excellent. Now, I've been instructed to ask you a little bit about your feelings on the computer games industry in general. On our show, we sort of talk about all kinds of games, and we recently talked about sort of the disconnect between developers and publishers. And as I understand it, you've had a lot of words about that.
So a couple of years ago, I wrote an article for The Escapist called "Death to the Games Industry, Long Live Games," in which I basically made the case that the digital games industry has gotten itself into a cul-de-sac where it's essentially incapable of sustaining the creative explosion that games have seen over the last 30 years into the future. When you say things like developers and publishers have problems, of course, developers and publishers are class enemies. just like authors and publishers are class enemies, or musicians and labels are class enemies. There are always going to be problems there. And in some ways, I've looked at kind of the deal terms and business conditions in a lot of different industries. Publishing is in some ways the least offensive. The publishers actually treat authors, by and large, reasonably well. And the music industry is, like, the most horrendous. So the games industry totally sucks, but at least it's not as bad as the music industry.
That is true.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned you've gotten back into doing freelance game design, and you mentioned, before we started recording, that you did a board game for Z-Man Games. And it's actually a game I sort of tangentially have only really heard about, and it's Megacore.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll talk about my three most recent projects. Megacorps, it's actually a game I started designing about 10 years ago. It's up to six players. It's a board game. Up to six players represent huge multinational conglomerates. And it's set in kind of a near future in which governments are now less important than big business. So as the players are kind of manipulating governments to screw the other players, and even occasionally fighting wars to take over countries so that they can then control the government there. But of course, profit is the actual arbiter of success. It's so satirical in tone. People have described it as a nasty game. Unlike most Euro-style games, there are real ways in which you can screw other people, and kind of negotiation is essential and critical to the game. Unfortunately, it has not gotten all that written on Board Game Geek, but what can I say? Another project I did last year, actually, was a game called Nightfall Bloodlines, which was a social network RPG designed for Plutum, which is like the number two game company in the social network game arena after Zynga. Very kind of conventional vampire-themed social network RPG, the one thing I did try to do is inject some element of story, so that as you go through the game and you gain level, you move from one place to another in the world, you encounter new people, and so it's not just a matter of increasing stats, there's also like a narrative that's revealed as you play.
Oh, cool.
And then the third, my most recent game is a weird thing. It was actually a board game funded by the MacArthur Foundation and distributed to after-school programs in the Chicago area. Last year was the 100th anniversary of Daniel Burnham's Plan of Chicago, which was kind of a landmark in urban planning and depicted the evolution of the city of Chicago over the course of the 20th century. And so the game is actually kind of about urban planning and development in the city of Chicago. Kind of Eurogame aesthetic to it, hopefully relatively straightforward rule set that you know, teenagers and high school students can play.
Yeah. Excellent.
So it's something that, you know, probably will never appear to anybody who is not a high school student in Chicago, although but it was an interesting project to work on, kind of serious board games.
Oh, that's cool. And why is it, on a slight tangent here, why is it you're known as Designer X?
Okay, so, so I've used the term the name Designer X in two cases, one of which was when I designed Violence, the role-playing game of egregious and repulsive bloodshed, which was less a game than kind of an angry screed about a lot of the things that I don't like about role-playing. The role-playing games industry, and was published as a line of games that were kind of experimental in nature, my initial idea, I didn't actually follow through with it, but my initial idea was that it would be Designer X, and I would, like, go to Gen Con wearing a paper bag over my head, and whine about how I was bitterly ashamed to be associated with this degrading product in any way, and so forth. And then the other time I used it was like 10 years ago now, maybe more. Rich Carlson, who's an independent game developer, put together something called the Scratchcore Manifesto, which was kind of an angry screed about the iniquities of the games industry and the need for creative innovation and for people to go off and, you know, break free of the constraints of the industry and create games on their own. And I wrote a big part of the Scratchcore Manifesto. I don't even know why. I think Rich at the time didn't want to admit that he had anything to do with this, because he still had hopes of, like, a job in the mainstream games industry at the time. So everybody who contributed to it had some kind of name like that, Designer X, Designer Y, blah, blah. But, you know, I'm now out about the fact that I am Designer X.
Well, looking at wrapping things up here shortly, when was the last time you got to pick up some dice and play a game?
The last time?
Yep, when was the last time?
Well, when I was at the Game Developers Conference just last week, I played a number of games, including Hey, That's My Fish, a board game. Not a bad board game. And I don't know, in a week or two, I'm having a play. I'm working on a second edition of Pax Britannica, a board game I designed 30 years ago at the moment. So in 2 weeks, I'll be having a playtest for that.
Cool.
And, of course, I'm playing indie computer games almost every day since on my website, Play This Thing, I review or the other contributors to the site review an indie game every weekday.
Excellent. My last question to ask is, one thing that Gamers Haven is about is sort of spreading the love of the hobby, and whether it be tabletop gaming or video gaming or basically any kind of gaming. What I'm asking everyone is what is it about this hobby that that you love? What is it that really drives you in this hobby?
Okay. So, yeah, I remember getting the Avalon Hill game catalog when I was a kid, and it really gave me the impression that these were games for smart people. And I've always had the feeling that games are a way of exploring or showing something about the real world that you really can't get in any other non-interactive medium. And that there's huge potential for games to change the way people think about things, change the way people approach problems, and to educate and inform people. Obviously, most of what gets published in any medium is kind of lowest common denominator shit that at best kind of titillates. But I still think there's enormous potential for the medium. And even if it hasn't always achieved that potential, it still holds out something different and novel as we move into the future.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to talk to me, of course. So, this has been a lot of fun, and again, thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Bye bye.
Gamers Haven Podcast proudly presents a companion game to Deadlands Reloaded, Enough Room to Die. Just who is the Lazarus Group, and what is their interest in this notorious band of outlaws that's crisscrossing the West? Follow them as they unlock the secrets to a plot worse than they could ever imagine. Deadlands. Hell hath no fury. Available for download at www.gamershavenpodcast.com.
Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.